Well, it was the late Zechariah Sitchin who brought us the story of the Anunnaki, but now Gerald Clark continues that incredible story, and we'll get right into it with his work, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, this is a subject that is near and dear to my heart. I just can't get enough of it, the Anunnaki. We're talking with Gerald Clark tonight. He's got, first of all, a Master of Science degree in electrical engineering. That's in electronic circuits and systems. He's got a Bachelor of Science in Computer Engineering. He was awarded several patents for his free space optical laser communications field. And back around 1996, he was working as a telecommunications executive. Somewhere along the line, he started to investigate the tablets left by the Sumerians. He's been to Turkey, Egypt, Persia, Iraq. He's been all over the place. Gerald, welcome to the show. Good to have you.
Thanks, George, and I want to say welcome to all your listeners as well. I really enjoy your show.
I'm looking forward to this. How did a person who has the kind of electrical background that you have and science background, computer science, how'd you end up being interested in stories like the Anunnaki?
Well, I was actually approached at a conference in Boston while I was a VP of Engineering at Lightpoint Communications by an interesting gentleman who represented an organization out of Turkey. And one thing led to another, and they approached us and wanted us to do some patent work with them to shore up a potential deregulated telecom market, much like what happened in Mexico. So we went down this path, and this was about the year 2001. While I was there, I realized I was dealing with some people who were pretty hard hitters. They're showing up in caravans and Mercedes, and they're really power players, and I didn't know anything about their country. So I noticed there were mosques around. The Muslim religion was the primary religion of the country.
Sure.
And very interesting shapes. As an engineer, I took in note that the mosque had a dome and a spire shape that looked like kind of like a UFO and a rocket. And I thought, well, that's an interesting thing to have together. But beyond that, the crescent moon and these small orbs on the top drew my attention. I thought, well, I'll go figure out at least a little bit about their culture so I won't have this ugly American syndrome next time I go over there.
Yeah.
And that's how it started. And while I was in that space, I was reading a book by Jared Diamond. And Professor Diamond wrote this book. It's a Pulitzer Prize winner called Guns, Germs, and Steel. And it just so happened that in that book, he mentioned a city in Turkey that gave me kind of a launching point that I could, had a little nugget that I could share with my clients. So it's so that I was looking into them a little bit. And it turned out to be the city of Tel Hayek that was quite old. And it was old enough that it exceeded the ages of the pyramids as we understood them in about 3100 BCE. And then we're talking a city that was anywhere from 9,000 to 12,000 years old. So all of a sudden, I was doing business in a country that seemed to be much older than what I perceived as the origins of history.
Were you baffled by what you were beginning to uncover?
Well, I was, and I have to give you a little background. While I was at Lightpoint, the telecom market in San Diego started to kind of recede, melt down, if you will, and we were given indication from our venture capitalists it was a good time to take a little hiatus. And and I thought, wow, wouldn't this be a great time after doing three startup companies and just burning it at both ends and go and read something I was really interested in? And I did notice on the History Channel, Discovery Channel, that there were ancient building sites that had structures like Baalbek, Lebanon, with the trilith on stones that we couldn't lift today. So there were mysteries of the past, and I thought, well, I'll take a little downtime, and I'll research some more of those. I'm an engineer, scientist, and it'll be fun for me. I'll write a book, maybe. Nothing serious, right?
And you did.
Well, it's 9 years later. But
yeah.
So while I was in that space and in researching, I stumbled across Zechariah Sitchin's first book on the 12th planet.
Great book, wasn't it?
It was a tremendous book, and back when I was looking at this, absolutely nobody was talking about anything that he was written. It was just fantastic stuff. And so I took the time to read everything he had and decided, you know, I'm going to keep this to myself and kind of just see if I can find physical corroborating evidence through the years and just see if he had any merit, because he was just such a profound scholar, giving you all the references to everything he wrote.
It was truly amazing research, Gerald. Mm-hmm. I remember, too, reading the 12th Planet and the subsequent Earth Chronicles books that he had. And
right.
I mean, I was just, I went nuts. I said, how can this be?
And I was like, who is this guy?
Hey, it's one of the greatest stories I've ever heard.
Exactly. And this, well, and that drew me in, and I started looking into this. And I realized that This gentleman, Major Henry Rollins, was in Persia about the 1890s, and he was a hobbyist archaeologist. And he was out perusing some sites, and he came across the Cliffs of Behistun. I'm not sure if you're aware of that, but
no.
it's a structure about 1,700 foot where they've got a picture of this winged disc inscribed.
Okay, I've seen the picture.
It's an interesting sight. I put it in my book. But through the process of him climbing up there and taking a piece of paper and rubbing it with a piece of pencil so he got an etching, he did, and there were thousands and thousands of lines. He took these back to the British Museum. And an interesting fellow who wasn't even trained as a linguist or an archaeologist, to my reading and understanding, took this and figured out from what he had written that he had three different languages there, and one of them was still active, and they knew how to read it. And so essentially it turned into the Mesopotamian Rosetta Stone that led us to the Tigris and Euphrates with all these buried temples along there and all the cuneiform tablets that were laying there buried in the mud.
Gerald.
So that really got me intrigued. I was like, wow, so this might be real what Sitchin's saying here, because there they are. They're overfinding this stuff.
Tell me how you used some of these influences to shape your research.
Well, let me start back. Early in my earliest childhood, I was interested in energy. I built a solar tracker in ninth grade, won a state science fair project.
You were one of those kind of kids, huh?
And it turned out that the Secretary of Energy, James Schlesinger, gave me a certificate. He was there. I didn't know who the guy was.
Yeah.
My science teacher, and this was in the northwest corner of Arkansas, by the way, in the middle of nowhere. And that's a long story. But anyway, so he gave me the certificate, and my science teacher was so excited about it. He told me, you know, that certificate will allow you to do some research in the future and probably get some grant from the government, and you can expand on this, on your research, which
sure.
You've done. And my tracker didn't take any energy, any power to do it. It just used some expandable gases and a servo to turn toward the sun. It was pretty simple.
How did you come up with that?
I think my father had subscribed to Popular Mechanics, and I think there was an issue laying around that was talking about solar trackers and different things like that. And I just got interested. I was interested in this space from a very early age, energy and matter particularly.
And are you still?
Well, I did, absolutely, and yeah. I will get to that, but as I went along, I was sponsored by the Association of Energy Engineers in college, so it kind of kept me going along. I was working in the space of artificial intelligence with some family members that started a startup company when I left the military, and so this kind of influenced my ideas about structure and function and energy, and I wrote several papers on this. Got exposed to evolutionary genetic algorithms, which I was trying to implement in hardware in grad school and such. So I was thinking about evolution, energy, and matter from a very early age in my life.
You sure were.
Yeah.
You sure were.
And I developed a significant love of physics while I was in graduate school and reading all of Richard Feynman and stuff. So applying physics to the real world is what we were doing at LightPoint. We were essentially using free space optics within the infrared laser to transmit like a piece of fiber through the air. So you could set up one of these little terminals and connect an internet connection quite rapidly at very, very high rates, gigabit speed rates. So where physics met the market was what LightPoint was all about. So I didn't really go beyond applying physics to the world until I got involved in structural integration.
All right, now how did this great mind for energy just come into the Anunnaki, which is strangely different?
Well, it started with my son, JJ. He was born with a genetic disorder called DiGeorge syndrome, and this was back in 1999.
What kind of syndrome is that?
It's a genetic anomaly where you can't predetermine from the parents that they'll get it, so it's completely random. It ends up being a deletion in the 22nd chromosome at the 11th protein marker, so they call it, another name for it is 22q delete. And it has about 200 symptoms, one of which, and I'll focus on that one for now, is low muscle tonus. Now, what's that? His connective tissue was really loose.
Ah, all right.
And so he had braces on his legs, and he could not walk even when he was five, and he had a helmet on his head to reshape it. He was just really, you know, his connective tissue was really loose.
Was it like...
It was having its way with him.
Was it like palsy, Gerald?
A little bit. And if you looked at his leg, it looked like the connective tissue had drifted down on the front of his leg, like a sock almost. It was really, and
wow.
I took pictures of it when I saw this. And that, through that process, I got introduced while I was at LightPoint as a VP of engineering. We were running triathlons, and I got introduced to structural integration by a fellow athlete I was having trouble with my structure. I was running, and I couldn't get off the bike and run without getting cramps. And he just said, well, check out structural integration. And it stuck with me, and I didn't really know what it was. But it turned out, as I looked into that, it looked like it could potentially be a solution for my kid, JJ, because this really interesting woman named Ida Rolfe, who, by the way, has a significant connection to Edward Case that I want to talk to you about later.
Okay, I gotta mark that down.
Yeah, she had been a researcher in fossil lipids, a PhD, really advanced. I mean, she was researching pioneering things when women's suffrage hadn't even come into play yet. So she wrote a seminal book that I listed in my.
So she was way ahead of her time.
She was a pioneer, truly. And so I read this, and she had a kid who had polio. One of his legs was mangled, and she was seeking a solution to get that kid so he could walk. Same issue I had. I was like, wow, I get that.
Yeah.
Same problem I have. So, and she went all over the world. I mean, I don't think she left any stone unturned. And the thing she discovered about the human body and how to change it led me, believe it or not, to the Anunnaki.
Now, how did that tie in?
Well, of course, I'd read.
Seems like stuff. A big jump.
Yeah, I had physician stuff in my head, and I read all his stuff, every bit of it. And I took notes. I have genealogy tables. I'm a scientist, and I'm checking him out. So it turned out that once I got a little more information on structural integration, this Ida Rolfe story, I thought, well, I got to go figure out how to do this for my kid. So I had it done to me first as an athlete. Well, let's see what it does. Does it work? It was profound, really profound. I mean, the energy changes and the structural changes I got, and it's all photographs you can see before and after, led me to think, you know, this is something I want to do for my boy. So I left engineering, took a very circuitous route to learn to be a structural integrator, and that landed me in Kauai, Hawaii, with Ida Rolfe's very first teacher, Emmett Hutchins.
Gorgeous out there.
And he was mystical. This guy had been doing this work for 35 years when I was there, and he's in his 70s, and he's still doing the work now.
Were you hopeful this was going to work?
Well, it was working for me, and I realized if I could figure out what they did, I could do this for my kid.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had no knowledge of the anatomy of my body. I had to go to some courses before that to learn anatomy and physiology before I could even participate in this domain. I had some downtime since telecom was melting down, and I was in a financial position where I could do this. But I got there, and I was the only engineer. Most of the other people in the class were body workers, you know, massage therapists, and people like that were progressing in their knowledge relative to the body. So while I was there, I just so happened, Emmett Hutchins was the very first person I'd ever shared my knowledge about the Anunnaki with. So we traded, and I respected him, and he respected me, and I felt like I wasn't crazy.
Now, had you started your research into the Anunnaki at that point?
Well, by that point, I'd read most of Sitchin's work,
okay.
But I wasn't talking about it.
But you weren't researching.
Okay. Well, I'd read it, but I wasn't actually, you know, it was a theory to me at that point, and I was corroborating. You know, I found that there were the physical gold mines that were owned by the Anglo-American Mining Corporation in Africa along the Zambezi River, just like the Sumerian account says. And there were a few other things that came up, you know, the structure of some of the cities that Sitchin talked about from a pilot standpoint, and how they were arrayed in various radii so that there was an approach blast to SAPAR, which he called the spaceport. Well, I've read VOR approach blasts as a pilot for years, and when I looked at it, I was like, yeah, you're right. That's exactly right. So it was very interesting.
So this tie-in, I don't see the tie-in.
You want to tie in Hawaii? Okay,
yeah.
So while I'm having this discussion with this very mystical guy who's Ida Rolfe's very first teacher, and turns out this is where I found out the connection with Edward Case, and I'm going to share something with you about that in just a second. So he also said something that surprised me as well, and that he was experimenting with something he'd read about in a colloidal solution of gold, and how it was affecting his energy and his consciousness and such. And,
right.
And these were very private conversations just between he and I.
and affecting it in a good way, right?
Well, in a good way. And,
yeah.
And as I was leaving the island, he said something absolutely profound to me that just still sticks to me today. He said, I don't know if I would want to live forever. I said, what are you into, mister? So one thing led to another. And as I researched further, I actually read Lawrence Gardner's book and really figured out what the Starfire gold was that he was talking about.
Oh, my
about.
Gosh. And, you know, he's passed away. Sad story.
Oh, yeah. What a wonderful author. Yeah. It's too bad. But profound author. I recommend everybody read his book, Genesis of the Grail Kings.
So you're seeing this connection between the gold and all
exactly.
that.
Exactly. So as I'm in Hawaii and getting this structural crazy body work to learn how to teach it and do it to my kid, I'm having profound changes in my energy and sensation of the sunlight, water, everything. Colors brighter. I was like, what's going on here? And as part of the coursework, we were required to write a graduation paper to explain our experience of structural integration. Well, the topic I chose as an engineer was structure is function and energy. So in that paper, I derive an equation that shows how the human energy body is related to gravity, wavelength, frequency, and weight, all things we can measure. So all of a sudden, I realized, well, I really stumbled on something interesting here. And it seemed to be the Anunnaki were using Star for a goal to prolong their life and affect their energy bodies. So I wanted to quantize that, and I did, and I put that in the book. It's really a fascinating
read. What was it, powdered gold or liquid?
Well, if you read David Hudson's patent, which he filed, and this is mentioned in Lawrence Gardner's book, he filed a patent. It's on Ormes Gold. You can go read it. It turns out that they were using a simulated process of annealing, smelting the gold to various temperatures. And if you know anything about how electrons go from their valence shell to an outer shell, or they're from their inner shell to a valence shell when you add energy, it's very similar to with a monoatomic element like gold. So you're heating it up, adding something to it. Turns out they're adding antimony. That's the secret element. And then when they bring it back down in temperature at various rates, it turns into a white powder with a large mass of it missing.
And they ingest that.
Well, that was the interesting part. So you go to ancient history and look at when Moses, in the Exodus account, was at the base of Mount Sarabet El Kadim, which is Mount Sinai, named after Nanar Sin, the wilderness of Sin, the moon god. Anyway, he got there, and of course there was smoke coming out of the top. Turns out, it would make a long story short, he goes up there. That's Hathor's temple. We have found it. We found lots of starfire gold underneath one of the stones in the floor, and it's been analyzed to determine exactly what that was.
So it was this quest to learn a little bit more about what the Anunnaki did with the gold to help your son. Now, did you ever end up treating your son with this?
Well, I did go and complete my structural integration training. As a member of the International Association of Structural Integrators for 7 years, I ran my own practice. I had no idea I was going to end up in full-time business, and I saw hundreds of clients and shared Ida Rolf's work with them, including my wonderful wife, who I dedicated my book to and trained her to do it as well. So, it's absolutely astounding work. I don't think it's any coincidence that I did it for 7 years.
I know, but Gerald, did you use it on your son?
Absolutely. So within 6 months of applying it to his legs, before and after pictures, plumb bob, grid chart, you know, like an engineer I do, he was standing up straight, no braces.
Amazing.
Jumping on a trampoline higher than anyone could imagine, and it was more balanced than any kid in his class.
And how is he now?
The same. Very limber, too.
So you're saying he's healed?
Well, from a structure standpoint, we've gotten a tremendous amount of healing. Is he completely healed? No, I need to spend a lot more time with him.
Is he still ingesting powdered gold, or?
Oh well, JJ isn't. Not at all. This was my contact in Hawaii. And speaking of that, I'll just share with you. It is available. You can buy it.
It's expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, it's about $120 for a small vial, and I've only ever tried it twice. And my friend said I was really righteous and hard to be around when I was like that. So
does it float with the price of gold?
It seems to. It seems to. Yeah. Now they're using other heavy metals, or like platinum and silver and other ones, to do these colloidal solutions. And I have no scientific knowledge.
All right, Gerald, when we come back, I want to get your take then on the Anunnaki, the Genesis account, and see how all of that ties right in. Gerald Clark with us, the Anunnaki of Nibiru. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Gerald Clark as we talk about his research work, the Anunnaki of Nibiru. Have you had a chance yet to look at our television program, internet-based? It is called Beyond Belief. Go to this website, beyondbelief.com. Simple as that. This Friday, our guest will be Dr. Robin Falco, talking about all things medicine in only the way that Robin can. Go to beyondbelief.com. And here we are back with Gerald Clark as we talk about the Anunnaki of Nibiru. Gerald, there are some out there who think that Zechariah Sitchin was wrong in his interpretation of those tablets. Your thoughts?
Actually, it depends on which tablets you want to start with. There's three very, very important ones that I like to focus on. And actually, Zechariah pointed us to these ones as well as his sources. And one of them was the Atrahasis. The second one was the Enuma Elish. And the third one was the Epic of Gilgamesh. Now, why are those important? Well, the Atrahasis account turns out to be, Atrahasis is a very important name. And before we go into the Sumerian version, I want to back up to the Genesis account. In our account in Genesis, it says, right in the beginning, it says, the Lord said, let us make man in our image. Our likeness. So that concern about the who is the plural in our was always at a focal point of, well, who are these people? There's more one. Then they mentioned the Nephilim and so on and so forth. And this was a basis for many people to launch a research into ancient astronauts.
Sure. Well, it sounds like if you look at Genesis only from the perspective of ETs coming down here, it fits like a T, doesn't it?
Well, it especially fits like a T if you know which one had his way in shaping it into a monotheistic account.
Good old Enki.
Well, that would be Enlil.
Or Enlil.
Yeah, so speaking of those names, in the Genesis account from the Sumerians, and in particular the Atrahasis, in that account it introduces us to the players that are on the Anunnaki Council. So there was an actual council of 12 people who ran things. And the top council member was Anu. His next member in charge was Enlil, whose rank was 50. And Enki was the next one, and his rank was 40. And those are the three key players in the true Genesis account. Not to leave out the female aspect, who was Nin-Hartzog or Isis, who participated with Enki.
I've wondered, Gerald, if these people, the Anunnaki, if they were castaways from their own planet. Or was this something more organized?
Well, in my book, I put together a little prehistory of Nibiru, which Zechariah Sitchin had researched himself. And it's in one of his very, very hidden away timelines of the history of the Anunnaki. And in that timeline, he mentions the prehistory on Nibiru about 450,000 years ago when Anu ended up as king. He ended up as king by resting away from an unjust ruler, Olalu, who was exiled. He left, came to Earth, discovered gold as an amends to try to get back in good with the Anunnaki hierarchy on Nibiru. He stated that this gold could heal their ailing atmosphere, which when it came in close perigee with the sun, being so far out past Pluto, according to Harrington, that it was damaging their atmosphere. So Anu dispatched his firstborn son, Enki, landed in the Persian Gulf, according to the accounts, was supposed to be able to mine gold there to send it back to Nibiru. Couldn't get it fast enough after setting up the city of Eridu, which we found. In 1973, the University of Chicago published pictures of the city of Eridu when they found it. And from there, basically their mission was to get gold however they needed to. And it landed them in South Africa along the Zambezi River where they, instead of getting it out of the ocean, they figured mining it was going to be much quicker.
And I assume they had the kind of technology to spot from space where the gold might be on this planet.
Well, exactly. We use spectroscopy now to see what a planet is composed of.
Right.
Now, and I'm sure that given they were more than 50,000 years at least ahead of us, that they were able to do that as well. And one thing, that without getting too far off track, is there is a Sumerian kings list that documents each of the rulers from that region, all the way back to the Genesis account when they say that they set up the first kingship in Eridu. So, you know, so there's some good Genesis account data. And when you finally realize that the Hebrew scholars that were taken captive in Babylon at about 330 BCE saw these Sumerian tablets for the very first time, which predated their records by thousands of years. And in order, and I put this in my book, and clearly what they've done in the Torah is to take those Sumerian documents in the flood story, the creation account, which are in infinite Sumerian detail. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, Gerald, the Sumerians were earthlings, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
At what point did they develop after the Anunnaki, let's say, left?
Well, it started much earlier than that, because if you go to the Atrahasis account, which Sitchin pointed us to, in there there's a clear account where the Ijiji miners that had been taken down to mine the gold, which they brought from Nibiru, mutinied under Enwal's command. Okay, so
they didn't want to do that. They didn't want to work.
Well, they'd been here for many shars, according to the record, and this is in the first tablet of the Atrahasis. And so one of the solutions was brought up to, well, let's potentially look at these Neanderthals that are roaming the steppes of Africa,
okay,
and jumpstart them to a primitive worker that could be useful to us. And this was a really, really a heavy topic that Enki pondered over, whether he should do this, because apparently slavery was against the law in Nibiru.
Well, and hence,
galactic law.
Hence came Adam and Eve that way, right?
Well, exactly. So in their account, Enki, with the council's approval, and Ninhartzog in their house of Shimti in Africa, which was his domain, did genetic experiments to come up with a primitive worker that could follow their commands and mine the gold and relieve the Ijiji miners. And it's in the account, and that's exactly what they did.
Did the worker look like we look now?
And well, exactly. One of the really interesting parts, this brings up this whole concept of the creation versus evolution debate. What did they look like? Well, according to them, Enki took his genetic material, mixed it with a Neanderthal, which he recognized was a viable species that was similar, that had evolved on their planet. This was kind of the key. Apparently in the Enuma Elish, which is their creation account, seeds of their planet were dispersed on our planet with a collision account. And it's kind of like a panspermia.
Right.
Yeah, so anyway, he recognized this life form, and he modified it, putting his mark on it. Okay, so the DNA that we have is hybrid Anunnaki and probably the original DNA from the creator of all, which they also alluded to as a being that they had an encounter on their planet.
Do we look like them?
We do look like them.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, exactly like them.
Okay.
But it does appear that they were taller than we were, but we do look like them.
They were the giants of old.
Yeah, well, they were shown to be approximately 12 feet tall when they were sitting in some of the cuneiform seals.
I guess they didn't want to create workers that could rival or attack them.
Well, that's the whole thing. And so in the account, they eventually create this Adapa. He wasn't able to procreate. They finally decide that they're not able to replicate them the way they work fast enough to meet the labor requirements. They allowed them to procreate. This is where Enki's firstborn son, or secondborn son, Ningxida Thoth, got involved. He was a premier scientist. His symbol was the Caduceus. And he got involved, upgraded their DNA, took them up to the Garden of Eden, which was in Eridu, and Enki and Enlil were there in the garden in the Genesis account when they were studying them to determine the effects of this DNA upgrade so that they could procreate.
How long do you think it took to create an Adam and Eve? I mean, did they go through full term and, you know, were they 20 years old? Or was this an instant genetic manipulation and there they were hanging inside of a test tube somewhere?
Well, they were kind of spawned in vitro because Ninhartzog carried the baby to full birth. It was a full-term baby, 9 months.
9 months.
Just like a baby. And they describe in their documents having a great time seeing how the babies were growing much quicker on this planet than they were on theirs based on the short orbital cycles of our planet, Earth around the sun.
That's
so it took them a lot longer to mature on Nibiru than it did on the Earth.
I know, but I mean, in terms of growth here of these genetically altered humans,
mm-hmm.
did they grow in real time or were they able to speed it up so a 20-year-old got to his point in 2 years, let's say?
Well, it did not look to me like they sped it up. As a matter of fact, one of the really interesting points I was watching in this whole thing was, okay, so they created us as a slave, and they messed with our DNA. What capabilities do we have, and what are our limits? They clearly stated we were given intelligence and a limited life of 120 years, not to be exceeded. So in my book,
they got really close to that, didn't they?
Yeah, there's one woman who actually ended up being 122 years and 164 days old. She was a French woman.
Well, now, in the Bible, they talk about, Methuselah, 900 years,
mm-hmm.
things like that. Were those Anunnaki?
Well, if you go back to the Sumerian kings list and those original pure Nibirian genotypes, they apparently had the ability to prolong their life indefinitely. And some of them at the very high levels that were ingesting starfire gold were doing just that. And we've discovered just recently in 2009, a couple of scientists were issued a Nobel Prize for their research into telomeres and longevity. And apparently the starfire gold is directly related to that.
How did they leave, Gerald? Are there any accounts on how and why they just left?
Well, from the wars and gods and men, written by Sitchin. It looked like they got into some significant skirmishes over control of their, quote, Bond Heaven Earth, which is their space facilities.
With each other.
With each other. And this was the, and I termed them the Enlilites and the Enkiites. So you had Enlil and Enki and their offspring, and they were constantly at war with each other, pretty much like the Hatfields and McCoys. And it's still going on to this day, by the way.
Here?
Yes.
Well, we'll get into that.
We'll get into that. So.
Okay, so they had this battle, this war. Did they use atomic weapons?
Well, yeah. So according to the accounts, Ninurta, Enlil's son, got an atomic weapon, used it against the Sipar spaceport because he could not fight off the onslaught of Marduk, who was Enki's first son, who was based in Babylon. So once this nuclear cloud contaminated the Mesopotamian region, apparently the only city that was spared based on the wind flow from west to southeast was Babylon. And Enki and Enlil and Anu on the council, they took that as a sign that Marduk was destined to be the new ruler on the earth. And he ended up taking over the council position as rank 50 in about 2000 BCE.
When we hear the biblical accounts of cities demolished, Sodom and Gomorrah, do you think that was the offshoot of the atomic war?
Well, absolutely it was. This was the Enkiites going at the Enlilites, if you will.
Well, so. And because they told the wife, you know, don't remember all my biblical stuff, but turn around.
Lot
and
was the brother of
who was the wife?
Abram, and who, that was you're talking about Sarah.
Yeah, she was the one who was told, "Don't turn around and look."
Oh yeah,
or you'll turn into salt.
That's a very interesting account in and of itself, where the nuclear account goes. It looks like Babylon was nuked. Marduk was building a spaceport. He wasn't building some crazy tower. He was building a space function that violated Enlil's right to command up in the Sinai.
So they took that out.
Yeah, so they wiped that out. And apparently the Sodom and Gomorrah account's a complete lie. The people there were, according to the real accounts, quite evolved. And they and their encounter with and holding Lot captive means that they were Enkiites.
Well, let's weigh two things, Gerald. One, the Anunnaki did all this. Or two, we had advanced civilizations back a long, long time ago, and they had this capability. Which one do you weigh?
Well, according to Paul Tellier, who's testifying in front of Congress, he says there were up to 20 alien species operating Earth for thousands of years. So were they just from Nibiru? Maybe not. The only reason I focused on the Anunnaki was because it looked like they were the ones that were genetic modifiers.
And they may have been the first ones.
Yeah. So, you know, but there, I believe there are other ones. And he mentions them from Zeta Reticuli, the Pleiades, a whole bunch of them.
So they had this disastrous war.
Mm-hmm.
What happens?
So at that point, Babylon hangs on, but everybody else starts heading east. And that's kind of the place where the Anunnaki Council of 12 turned into the Greek pantheon at Baalbek, Lebanon.
Now that's interesting.
Yeah, so so Zeus is Enlil, which like I put on the back of the book.
Okay.
And Enki is Poseidon. So Poseidon and Zeus, you know, it's great mythical fun from Marvel Comics, but this was real stuff. These were real beings, and they represented creation and destruction, just like Zoroastrian religion specified they did.
Because the mythology, when you really look at it, and then you try to apply it to, you know, real life ETs, it does all fit, doesn't it?
It does. So all of a sudden, where my head started spinning is when I was researching the city of Ur, where one of the lamentations of Ur was where the people were crying out to their local deity, Enlil, about the destruction of the place. It happened three times. Well, in the third dynasty of Ur and its destruction, they mention Enlil's name in this tablet, but they also call him Yahweh. So all of a sudden, wow, you find out the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was an ancient Anunnaki astronaut living in the city Ur.
Now you're going to really get some people's ire up. So are you saying?
Yes, I am saying.
I don't think you're saying there is no God. I haven't heard that come out of you.
No, this may be an offshoot a little bit. Enki did not view himself as God. He viewed himself as a scientist and a genetic manipulator, just like we have in labs all over the country today. But he did mention in his Lost Book of Enki and several other accounts where they had encounters with the creator of all. That's what they called them.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. So now, creation and evolution, that debate. All of a sudden, evolution is a real thing. But if you come in and you interrupt it with a genetic modification, now you got a creation account that goes with that evolution.
That's right.
They're not mutually exclusive.
That's right. And some of the evidence, let's talk about some of the evidence for a moment, Gerald. Mm-hmm. One thing that fascinates me is in Egypt, Abydos. That tablet, how big is that thing? It's pretty good size, isn't it?
It's crazy. I think you're referring to the evidence of the H-64 Apaches.
Yes.
The
looks like a helicopter or a submarine.
Well, being a helicopter pilot in the Army, that really resonated with me as well. And I listed that in my book.
It's clearly a helicopter, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Listen, in the Mahabharata, in the Indian documents, they clearly talk about Vimanas and flying ships.
Yep.
Battling each other. And you go into the Wars of Gods and Men, where Horus and Seth were in aircraft battling each other, firing missiles.
So is this the Battle of the Anunnaki that you were just talking about?
Well, yeah, they had multiple ones, multiple battles. And then Sitchin's premier book, The War of Gods and Men, he details several of them.
Well, no wonder we're like them. We're a warring group of people.
Exactly. We got many of our attributes from them. It shouldn't be a surprise that we're just like them.
But how old is that tablet in Abydos?
I believe that one is
thousands
easily before 3800 BCE.
Easy.
You know, it's like 5,800 years old.
I mean, it's dramatic.
It's amazing, yeah. Well, they found little artifacts like that all around the world that don't seem to jive well with the level of knowledge that they had, you know.
So. I had Michael Tellinger on a week or so ago, and you know, he is a great Zachariah Sitchin booster, mm-hmm, as well, Gerald, you know, as you are.
There were a couple other are you looking for any more documentary evidence to say the Anunnaki were real?
Sure.
Well, there was a couple that I ran into. I was working up at Cal IT2 at UCSD here in San Diego, and I ran into some guys from the Smithsonian Channel that were down doing a presentation. They had a really nice presentation room. And they were talking about the DNA studies that they had sponsored, and that you could sign up for them. And it was really, really interesting. And it turns out that there were two studies to find out who our original male and female were, our original Adam and Eve. And they did it with genetics. Are you aware of this?
Yes.
Okay. So I'll abbreviate. Yes. So you had the genetic Eve study, where they were looking for the mitochondrial DNA. And they led that back to the Zambezi River pretty much 200,000 years ago. And then the genetic Adam study, same thing. Well, it turns out that location is coincident with where these Anunnaki gold mines were. So so the fact that Tellinger is there corroborating that, I'm sure Sitchin is quite happy about that. So I would be.
God rest his soul.
Yes, indeed.
I want to talk with you about DNA next hour, Gerald, when we come back, and genetics and eternal life and what they're doing. But why did they leave, Gerald? Why did they leave? Think about that. Gerald's website, of course, doesn't have one, but he's got a book. It's called The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators and Slavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order, which we'll also talk about that. Follow us, by the way, on Facebook, Twitter, and now Instagram, all of that in the far right-hand corner at coasttocoastam.com. And you can always email me at george@coasttocoastam.com.